ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, I'm Dominique Bayens. Just ahead of politics now, I want to tell you about my new podcast, Expanse, The Nanup Four. 2 decades after 4 people disappeared in WA, those left behind are still asking, was it a vanishing act or murder?
I'm starting to think this is not going to end well.
After their disappearance, a complex picture of deceit, control and cults came to light. Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party. Change or die.
Politics is the brutal game of arithmetic, but no one's going to vote for you if you don't stand for something.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis and I'm joining you from Ngunnawal country in Parliament House in Canberra.
And I'm Fran Kelly on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation in Sydney.
Now, huge week, aren't they all? Only one story, though, has dominated the week and it makes sense. That's the US-Israeli joint strikes on Iran. And the way Australia has responded to that conflict, the way the world has responded to that wider now regional conflict, really a watershed moment in global politics and I think really points to the rewriting of the rules or the entire real-time collapse of the so-called rules-based order. We're going to take a look at how Anthony Albanese has met this moment.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting week for looking through that particular lens, PK, because the Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney is visiting Australia at the moment. He's basically on a world tour, really, with his message that middle powers need to untether themselves from the hegemons, from China and the US, at this time of superpower might, and might is right. Now, he's talking not just in strategic terms and security terms, he's also talking in economic and trade terms. Basically, you know, he says the writing's on the wall, so we'd better get our act together collectively and start striking different kind of liaisons, new trade agreements and defence bargains. We're recording this on Thursday morning. He's about to meet the Prime Minister and then he's about to address the Federal Parliament. Mm. So it's a big week because that is a very significant message from the Canadian Prime Minister, and it will in its own way, I think, invite our Prime Minister in but also put some pressure on our Prime Minister.
Fran, that's not the only thing. In the domestic political sphere, we'll talk about the Liberal election review, which was tabled in the Parliament in something that Andrew Hastie himself, who's a Liberal frontbencher, called a boss move by the Prime Minister. So there you go. Unusual sort of framing from him, showing that he kind of could see what the Prime Minister was doing. That was made public, of course, Fran. It was scathing. We're going to take a look at how the new Liberal leader has performed this week. He's been criticised for taking an approach which, you know, focused on ISIS brides rather than the economy, although Wednesday was Economy Day. Fran, first the Middle East, though. Our guest today has been very busy filing on the biggest story of the world, of the week, of our times. Cameron Stewart is the Chief International Correspondent at The Australian. Welcome to The Party Room, Cam.
Thanks, PK and Fran.
Hi, Cam, and thanks for your time. You've been on front page every day, really, since these strikes broke out, so we do appreciate your time. Before we start, Cam, let's remind everyone how the Prime Minister, our Prime Minister, not Canada's, responded to the news of these US-Israeli strikes on Iran.
Australia stands with the brave people of Iran in their struggle against what is an oppressive regime. We support the United States acting to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon and to prevent Iran from continuing to threaten international peace and security. We are concerned about regional escalation and urge the protection of civilians. For those on the ground...
Where to start? Is this the week that redefined the global rules-based order as this war against Iran escalates into this full-blown regional conflict? And was our government's, the Australian government's response, in line with that of others we call allies? I'm thinking of, yes, Canada, but also the UK and European partners, particularly France and Germany, because there are plenty of people here in Australia critical of the Prime Minister's initial message, describing it as acquiescence or a lot of love for Trump. What do you think?
Well, I think all Western democracies have tie themselves up in knots here a little bit, Fran, in the sense that there is a fundamental contradiction, because the concept of international law, it's very hard to say that Israel and US have met that standard in attacking Iran in the way that they have. However, Western democracies are very happy to see the nuclear threat, or whatever the nuclear threat might have been, from Iran removed. Australia also has a lot of interest in removing the Iranian regime, or at least weakening it, given what's happened here in Australia. And so I think we've got an inherent contradiction here. And Albo had a different slant to the European countries. UK and France, and Spain in particular, really have opposed, or at least been very concerned about, these strikes on the basis of international law. But Anthony Albanese's approach has been to say that's a matter for the US and Israel. And in a way, he sidestepped that and he said, we back it. And so he has a more nuanced position than the European countries.
Yeah, he really does. In fact, yesterday on Afternoon Briefing, I had Ed Husic on, who, of course, was on the front bench, now isn't, and has been an outspoken critic, I think, on issues of Gaza. He actually did back the government taking this position. However, he wasn't as ambiguous as you just rightly described the Albanese government. He said what you said. It does break international law. However, there's a reason for why the action has been taken and can be justified.
I mean, it's a vexed issue. I mean, yes, it is clearly outside of international law, and it's contentious within the US as well, where members of Congress argue that that is a matter that gets debated within Congress as well around that. And I come back to my starting point about it being vexed because...
really interesting that the Albanese government, the official spokespeople, not their backbench, have been a lot more cautious, because I suppose it's harder for them, the stakes are higher. As soon as they say, Cam, like that... The international law has been broken, that opens a can of worms for them, doesn't it? Like, how can they say they're still in favour of international law and the rules-based order and concede that it's broken? So they've been much more ambiguous. Have I got that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And look, it's very hard, I think. I think Pennington and Albo would, if they took the international law stance, it would be very awkward for them. Because, and I think that Australia is an interesting case, especially because we've seen Iran, the regime, sponsor attacks here in Australia, the burning of a synagogue according to ASIO, the firebombing of a restaurant in Sydney. If we reverse the argument here, PK, and if Albo was very tepid about this action in Iran, he would be criticised quite strongly by people who said, how can you even start to semi-defend this regime that's carried out attacks in Australia? So I think once they sorted out the neat way to describe the international law issue by saying that it's a matter for the US and Israel, I think they were very clear to be able to support these strikes in a way that they might not otherwise be able to.
But Cam, every time I hear Penny Wong or the Prime Minister say that, I don't understand that. How can international law be only a matter for the players that may or may not be in breach of it? I mean, if it's international, by definition, it's a matter for the global institutions. And Mark Carney makes the point that, you know, America did not take this to the UN. He did not take this to his allies. I mean... it's clearly in breach of international law. I have not found one international legal expert who says it's not. There must be a way to acknowledge. I mean, Carney, I think, said it's inconsistent with international law. He's finally said that. Why can't our government do that and somehow say, you know, but, and just keep stressing, but, you know, Iran was, you know, an outlier, was a rogue state, and it's threatening the globe, and, you know, we need to... these actions need to be supported or something.
It's interesting.
It makes no sense to me.
Yes, Anthony Albanese could have taken more of the European line, where he was more uncomfortable about that clash. But he chose not to. I think...
is he scared of Trump and America and blowback?
Yeah, because that's the framing from the left, isn't it? Yeah.
I think Albo has basically tried to make himself a small target all the way through Trump's presidency. He's really not disagreed with him very much at all. He had a bit of a go at him about tariffs, but it was a fairly mild one. I mean, his policy has been quite different to the Europeans. Europeans have made quite a lot of noise, and they've been hit by Trump as a result, the European leaders. And you know, that's a tactic that I think this government has deliberately adopted. Keep a very low profile, and you don't get hit. We keep the alliance going under the water, if you like, the iceberg under the water, you know, military intelligence ties, keep that all nice and steady and try and avoid political conflict. And I think, Fran, that might explain this framing from the government in relation to this conflict in Iran.
Which all goes back to the Carney message, doesn't it? That the middle powers need to untether themselves from the reliance, the trade alliances, the strategic alliances, even the defence alliances. I mean, his big message is we should work together, and that's what they're going to do. They're going to make new agreements while they're here, I imagine.
With that global architecture now breaking down from consecutive crises, I've come to Australia at your invitation to reaffirm our alliance and to suggest where it can go next. Because it's my fundamental belief, as a result of optimism I've picked up from people from this great country, that from this rupture we can build something better, more prosperous, more resilient.
And also, we shouldn't pretend that this is the first time international law has been broken in this. I mean, we're seeing a completely new era here. You know, I mean, you can argue that certainly the Trump administration's kidnapping of Nicolas Maduro, the former Venezuelan president, was inconsistent with international law. Of course, Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine was. Xi Jinping's annexing of islands in the South China Sea. I mean, this is the new big power world that we're
and
living in.
And it's not that new, not George W. Bush in Iraq.
Exactly. It's not that new. It's just much more emphasized now because we have a US president who's quite willing to go that extra mile and highlight this inconsistency.
Now, the UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer, we've talked about how Europe has taken a different perspective. He found himself in the US president's bad books for not joining the offensive strikes against Iran. Starmer's been really interesting here. He really put on the charm offensive, didn't he? And he really got, early on in the Trump presidency, a couple of deals which showed that the approach he was taking, flattering Trump, saying, you know, come here and meet the king, you know, special trip for you to Donald Trump. And Trump obviously loves that sort of stuff. We've got a different perspective. Why so different between Starmer and us, though?
Well, look, Starmer has got himself caught between the ghost of Tony Blair over Iraq and Donald Trump. Basically, he's very wary of supporting this. He's very fearful of the same disaster politically that overtook Tony Blair after he supported the move in Iraq. But I think that was a mistake from Starmer's perspective in the sense that you've seen what Trump said about him not being a Churchill. So he's fallen down that the cracks in the middle of those two choices and found himself in a very difficult position. Anthony Albanese has taken a much safer position just backing the strikes. But of course, you know, that leads, as you were saying at the start, that leads to criticism from the left towards Albo for being acquiescent. But I honestly think the criticism towards Albo, had he gone the other way, would have been harsher and more fierce.
And it would have been more ferocious too from the opposition. And there is presumably always domestic politics involved in this. We've seen, I think, a particularly strong intervention from the Shadow Industry Minister, Andrew Hastie. His point is that, and I thought he did this quite adroitly, he stayed within his portfolio terms, but he also basically wade straight into this notion of is this an illegal war?
Look, I think we're in a new stage of history. After World War II, it was the United States who built the international order, the international institutions. That's why the United Nations is headquartered in New York. And I think that that construct is defunct, in a sense. We've got a different president who is mercantilist when it comes to his sort of economics. I think he's an apex opportunist. This is a very different stage of history. And my concern foremost by making those comments is to wake Australia up.
He really played this strongly, I think, to a domestic audience in terms of, you know, this is justified on the grounds of that national security issue because of, as you say, those Iranian-backed and controlled terror anti-Semitic attacks in Australia. And so he's really playing the national security card here very strongly. And I think that's the Prime Minister's best angle here that people will really respond to, that this has happened on our soil, so we need to and are justified in taking this stand here, this support.
And Fran, as well as that, there is a sort of a moral ballast in the debate, in the sense that the Iranian regime, you know, slaughtering how many, maybe 30,000 of its own people in January, And, you know, and a truly a repressive regime that does have a nuclear program that makes a lot of countries very uncomfortable. There is a fair bit of moral ballast you can also add to what Andrew Hastie is saying. You can argue the other way on various points, of course, but I think that makes this a much smoother position for the Australian government to take a more positive stance in backing the strikes.
Because we're all seeing the pictures of Iranians in Iran and around the world cheering and dancing on the streets. You know, this has got a lot of support at home.
That's right. That's right. This is not, you know, this is not a hugely unpopular conflict, but it's a conflict that's making everyone so nervous, though, because it's just such a big thing. It's easily the biggest gamble Trump's taken as president in either of his terms, and we don't know where it's going to go. There's absolutely no chance of a long-term war that America will stay stuck into. They will hit and they will leave. The old Colin Powell doctrine that, you know, if you break it, you know, you own it. This is not the Trump doctrine. The Trump doctrine is if you break it, they own it.
It's so well put. Look, of course, there is the human cost, the realignment of the world, the international law, and then there's the biggest elephant in the room, which is the economic fallout, right, for ordinary people. And the way most Australians will respond to it will absolutely be through that prism, I think, to be fair, right? The government and the markets, the RBA governor, everyone is alive to this. The immediate impact, I think, is, of course, at the petrol bowser. We've seen these people lining up for it. We've had the government write to the ACCC and say, you know, watch petrol gouging, because, of course, people try and game the system, businesses try and game the system. But, Fran, I'm going to throw it to you. You know, the government is already framing the budget that's coming up around this war, aren't they? Is this about them avoiding the economic responsibilities they already had?
Well, I don't think it's about them avoiding it. I think they're trapped. They're trapped here. I mean, already last week we were talking about the pressure that Jim Chalmers and Katie Gallagher are under with this framing this budget, given the inflation pressures. We've already seen an interest rate rise. No sign that, you know, inflation's going to be tempered anytime soon. And now we've got this inflationary impact of the ships being blocked in the Straits of Hormuz, this energy supplies being depleted and blocked, and what that will mean to prices of gas and not just petrol for motorists, though I've got to say, Cam, gouging is going on there already. I drove past a petrol station on the way to work, $2.48 a litre at one of them.
Yeah, they're the kryptonite for governments. I mean, petrol prices are you know, a nightmare for governments. It's a nightmare for Jim Chalmers, as you say. There's nothing he can do. It's interesting. Donald Trump is quite awake to this. He's quite one thing that does he does respond to, one of the very few things he responds to, are global markets and energy prices. And, you know, if global markets really start to fall heavily in this conflict, he will take that into account. He's actually reversed positions and modified policy on that basis sometimes. And it's interesting, yesterday we saw that he said that he'll have naval ships escort tankers through the Strait of Hormuz if necessary. And that's certainly, he's very aware that energy prices are dangerous to him politically and, of course, by de facto to the Australian government. It's a real problem for the budget.
Yeah, it certainly is a problem for the budget. And, you know, this is budget time now. This is what Katie Gallagher and Jim Chalmers are spending their time on. And they'll be crafting and recrafting, rewriting as we speak. And this will probably, depending on how long this war goes on, they're going to have to build that narrative of this is a problem. And Jim Chalmers was out there already today, PK, doing that.
Yeah, his whole mantra is all about getting everyone prepared for that difficult set of circumstances. The problem, though, for Jim Chalmers is that a lot of the problems we had, I'm not saying that the issues, inflation, petrol, all of that won't spike as a result of this. It's a fact. Everyone concedes that. Even the coalition, who wants to criticise the government and that's their bread and butter, concedes that that's the point that's going to happen. That happens, obviously, with conflict. But some of the problems we're seeing in the economy and the sort of inflation that appears to be stuck with us predates this conflict.
I mean, first of all, what I'm trying to acknowledge is that we had considerable economic challenges even before the escalation of the conflict over the weekend. Inflation, productivity, global economic uncertainty. And in at least two out of three of those areas, the conflict in the Middle East will make those challenges more difficult rather than easier. We're just being upfront about that. And for us,
I think there's a danger. Fifth budget is about to deliver. And Cam, I'd love to get your thoughts on talking about the previous government still. They're getting to a point now where they need to sort of take full responsibility. It's been too long. And now it's very much in their inbox. And yes, you can frame it around international events, but that budget is your responsibility. That's the job. It's on the description. It's called government, right?
Cam, do you want me to take that, given you've got your head in the Straits of Hormuz?
Yes, you can take that, Fran.
Yes. No, I think that's right, PK. That time has passed almost. So I do notice Jim Chalmers saying, well, inflation was, I don't know, what was it, 6.8% when we came to government. But yeah, I think that time is over. That's true. And I think Jim Chalmers is trying to, by saying to the Australian people, look, this is going to be very difficult. We're going to be straight with you. That's his way of doing it. It's not the only job of government. As we've said a million times on this podcast, PK, government is tricky, is difficult. It's hard. And we've heard the foreign minister this week say that, you know, that the situation for us, there's 115,000 Australians across the Gulf region, all those countries under attack. The airports have been closed. It's an incredibly tense and stressful and dangerous situation for a lot of people and a lot of Australians. And Penny Wong has labelled it our biggest consular crisis ever, which is, if you think back to those images of RAF jets trying to get people out of Kabul as the Taliban rolled into town, you know, that's saying something. But Penny Wong was on AM this morning and I could just sense, I don't know, I almost felt her or heard her breathing out, I reckon, at the fact that she can now say the first plane of Australians is home. Maybe three more planes are going to leave today.
I understand, and I want to make sure I'm very careful about this, because things can cancel at the last minute because we are talking about a conflict zone. But I understand there are three flights scheduled today from the UAE.
They feel like, you know, maybe we're going to get people out here, because, you know, there is no way if the airspace is closed, right? There is literally nothing a government can do, is it, Cam?
No, it's been an unbelievable situation, because, I mean, you know, over the years, that Middle Eastern hub has become the key. It's the old kangaroo route, you know, I mean, and it's just a massive disaster for that to be closed down.
We've got university campuses in a number of those countries.
Yep. Absolutely. I mean, you know what, 24,000 people in Dubai alone. It's extraordinary, 115,000 across the region. It's a massive thing. And I'm really, I think Penny Wong is very relieved, because I don't think people thought that the flights would get out, or some flights would get out this early. So there's been an agreement with Iran, which is unusually, given what's happening in Iran. There's been an agreement to get a very narrow sliver of safe airspace that you can get a certain amount of flights out. And that's, I think, a great relief to Australia. Who knows if it'll continue? It all depends entirely on whether Iran continues to attack the Gulf states. Last 24 hours, they've slowed down in that. But if they start again, that airspace will be closed again. So it's certainly not a solved problem. And they know it.
And that's the reason they're trying to close down those airports, because they're trying to inflict economic pain, aren't they, on US and Israel, but US in particular, by closing down these hubs.
Yes, and more than that, exactly. They're trying to persuade those Gulf countries to lean on Donald Trump and say, look what you're doing. This is chaos.
This is killing us. Stop it.
Stop this conflict. Get it over and done with. That's what Iran is betting on. But the initial response from those Gulf states has actually been to throw them into America's camp, because they're so annoyed at what Iran has done. So that's the gamble that Iran is trying to do. I don't think it's working for them.
One more thing, though. I had James Patterson on the show yesterday. He's the shadow defence spokesperson now, but, you know, really senior, obviously, in the coalition. And he said he was really critical of the government's response in evacuating Australians, actually. He said he believes that their approach has been flat-footed, that they did not give enough warning, even when we knew there was a military build-up from the US, like something was looming.
But I do have to say, I think the government's response to this crisis has been a bit flat-footed so far. We have 115,000 Australians stranded in the Middle East, many of whom might have chosen to leave had they been more directly warned by the government last week that this was a possibility.
I mean, we knew something was looming. He's right there. We'd been reporting on it for weeks. Didn't know which way Trump would end up jumping, but last time he also broke, remember, that period of negotiation. So it ended up being exactly a version of that, right? And that Australians should have been told to evacuate, or travel warnings should have been put on these nations earlier.
They were.
Well, no, they weren't. Not
yeah, they were.
Week.
Yeah, they were. We've had smart traveller warnings. Penny Wong's been out for a couple of weeks saying people should leave, you know, Beirut, they should leave certain countries. I think personally,
not all of those places. I mean, it's anyway. Cam, what do you reckon?
I think James Patterson is probably playing politics more than anything else in that. You have squadrons of commercial airlines coming in and out of those airports every single day. That is going to be the case regardless. They're not going to suddenly stop flying on the prospect of something happening. They're just going to wait until something does happen before they close down those routes. And I just don't think there's anything, given the scale of Australians who pass through that area, I don't think there's anything the government could have realistically done. And, you know, it's not the Australian government who's been caught flat-footed. Every other country in the world has been caught flat-footed.
And also, I mean, I think you're right to some degree, PK, in that the warnings have been mainly to people in Beirut and countries like that. No one expected Iran to strike so broadly across the Gulf, because that's risking, as you said earlier, Cam, the sort of the goodwill of those Arab countries, those Arab neighbours.
Exactly. In fact, Penny Wong, I think, was right when she said, look, frankly, we didn't know they were going to strike 10 states.
I think that's right. I think that's right. So I think your point about them playing politics is fair. Obviously, they're trying to also press perhaps the political buttons of the many people who are stranded, who feel frustrated. Although I've seen many interviews with people, people are pretty reasonable, aren't they? They're like, the government, I think, is trying to help us as much as they can. You know, like, people understand and are very, there's frustration, but equally they understand that our government can't control everything that's happening in the world, right?
It was very interesting. The UAE is paying for hotels and food for people there. That was quite remarkable. I wouldn't have thought they would have had to do that.
It's a big project getting that many people home. And if you're there, and I know people even listening to this podcast are there, actually, I've been contacted by people. You know, it's intense. Imagine just your timing and being stuck and how petrifying that would be.
I think we all know someone who's been affected.
Mm. It's intense. Yeah. Hey, Cam, you know how much I love you. We used to work together, of course, and I always loved having you on the pod. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Great, as always. Thanks, Cam.
That was excellent with Cam, wasn't it, Fran? I mean, I love it. I love that he's calling out of that. I think it's just politics, Patricia. He's so good. I mean, I think there was a lot of politics there. I think that's right. Look, Fran, let's talk about some other things if we can. Obviously, international events dominated the week, which is why we focused on them. But Parliament was in session, was dominated by this issue, but also, weirdly, lots of other issues. Anthony Albanese commemorated his 30th year in Parliament, and Angus Taylor spent his first week in question time as opposition leader.
I wanted to ask you about that, PK, because you're down there, right? Has he been, you know, I've seen quite a few opposition leaders take their first day at the dispatch box. Was he reveling in this new role at question time? How'd he go?
Okay. I think he was okay. I don't think, you know, you'd say it was a disaster for him, but did he come out of the block sort of firing on all cylinders? No, I don't think so. And it's more in the strategy than I think the actual performance. The performance was workmanlike, you know. I'm not saying sort of, wow, never seen anything like this, but was a competent job. However, the questions, so obviously question time, boom, boom, is about the opposition comes up with a strategy, what will they be pushing? It says something about the things that they identify as important, what they want to really zero in on. First couple of days, and this was widely rebuked, can I say, even from sort of right-leaning papers. Dennis Shanahan kept getting quoted in the paper. Yeah. He's an old colleague of mine. Of course, I sit next to him in question time. So, you know, a lot of jokes between us about how often he got mentioned. The reason he was mentioned is because, you know, he works for a right-wing paper, The Australian. He spent a lot of his time sort of quizzing, confused about why ISIS brides and the government's handling of that issue was the main question line from Angus Taylor, when the economy's stupid is the biggest yarn in town and the government knows it's under pressure on it.
Prime Minister, there are reports that at least 34 passports have recently been issued under this government to facilitate the return of individuals who left Australia to join ISIS. What? Can the PM confirm that none of his ministers, nor any member of staff,
Then they were mocked, Angus Taylor and his team, for Wednesday being Economy Day, right? So that's something that the Oz had written. And so that was mocked by the government. So it's Economy Day today. They asked questions about the economy. It took them half the week. Now, the opposition has been very busy trying to defend this approach, saying, well, you know, there's two things we care about, way of life and these issues around values, and then the economy. And so we've done both. I don't know, though. I thought that it was a poor strategy and they ended up looking silly. And also they didn't achieve anything out of the ISIS bride stuff. There was no achievement. They haven't found their smoking gun. I don't know if they think they're going to find one, but the government, you know, whatever you think of what they've done, they're not really like, you know, putting on special charter planes for these women. So,
no.
Yeah.
I think that's right. And I think, look, if I can try and get my head into the coalition leadership team mindset, heaven forbid, I think they were thinking we scored some goals, they reckon. With this, put the government under pressure in the last 2 weeks before the sitting week. The war has started. That's changed everything, I think. Mm. But the one caveat I would say is, you know, yes, cost of living is the most important thing. But let's remember during the election campaign, cost of living was still the most important thing, number one issue for everybody. The government was trying to keep it there. But the election of Donald Trump had a huge impact on the election result. It brought people away from the coalition and towards Labor, no doubt about it. And both sides accept that because I think people thought that Donald Trump is a threat on a number of levels. I've seen national security issues over the decades come up and bite Labor badly, often and significantly, and cause them real damage. So I think that this notion that, yes, hip pocket nerve, cost of living, that's what people are on about. I also think that the issues of national security are very deeply unsettling for people and they can cause damage. I think that the coalition, the point you made there was they didn't really score goals with that, and trying to get airtime for it in this time when there's this war going on in the Middle East was probably a misfire.
I think it's definitely a misfire. And I think that some of them realise that. Also, just as a new opposition leader, it was an important week, I think, for Angus Taylor to establish what would be his vibe, his thing. He made some quiet moves which probably didn't get as much of a run. For instance, he turned up to the Australian Financial Review's big conference. Now, that was his way of resetting with a big end of town when we know that Peter Dutton had a really terrible relationship with the big business, right? So a different approach from Angus Taylor, who is a kind of business dude. So he was quietly doing some of these things. But in terms of a strategy, it's about chasing that one nation vote. Interestingly, and it's worth mentioning this before we just get to the coalition's review or the Liberal Party's review and the way that was tabled in Parliament, which is wild. But Fran, there was this one moment that everyone in Parliament is talking about, right? And I want to share it with you because it was a moment.
Please.
So we had... There was a moment where Barnaby Joyce, who is now One Nation, of course, stands up and asks hats off to him, asks the best question that's been asked, which is how many days of reserve do we have of petrol, basically, right?
Yeah.
The best question that was asked, the coalition.
Missed
it. Obsessed with ISIS brides. Here we have the One Nation dude. So he's very different to Pauline Hanson, though. And what he's rebranding One Nation with, or trying to, is about the economy, your petrol, the stuff that matters to Australians. And it spoke volumes about how they're not getting it. Today, David Littleproud saying he thinks they might come last, this is the Nationals, in the Farrer by-election. Now, Barnaby Joyce is already out there attacking him, saying, how terrible is this once great party I loved? Like that they have just given up so much. Are you getting what I'm saying here? It's about the issues you're focusing on.
No, I think that's exactly right. And that is petrol prices. What did Cam call it? The kryptonite of governments. And, you know, we did get that answer from the government. It was forced by Barnaby Joyce. The minister said there was 36 days worth of petrol supplies, 34 days worth of diesel reserve and 32 days worth of jet fuel. That didn't strike me as very much, PK. But anyway, that's another podcast. But Barnaby Joyce also was at that Australian Financial Review Business Summit. And he importantly said out loud, if the Liberals and One Nation don't do a preference deal, then the conservative side of politics will be in their malaise forever. So, you know, he can see the numbers. He can see that combined, they can cause a lot of problems for Labor at the next federal election. But in the short term, in Farah, that's the way to get a Conservative candidate elected. But of course, that candidate's likely to be One Nation. And so he's trying to box them in, really, to wedge them. And I thought that was quite interesting. And PK, of course, just briefly before we go, in the midst of this, the PM pulled out that boss move, to quote Andrew Hastie, and tabled the Liberal Party's own election review, which they decided to not make public. Boom.
Boom. Oh, wow. Boss move. Okay. Definitely a boss move. I agree with Andrew Hastie. It is. Okay, the background story, which people have probably heard, but just a reminder, we've got Peter Dutton, who sees this review while he's actually overseas in the US, just loses his mind over it, you know, thinks, I can't believe they've written these things, says to the Liberal Party, I think some of these things you've said about me are defamatory. The Liberal Party presses pause, gets legal advice. Then Angus Taylor gets elected. He has a couple of meetings. They speak with all the people. And then they're like, let's just not put this out. Too much trouble. Not worth the trouble. As soon as they do that, it gets leaked. That's the way it works. PM gets the Labor Party gets access to it. They table it, which means no defamation, man. It's in the Parliament. It's on the record. We can all access it through the Parliament because it's in the official record.
Now, I'm asked about transparency, Mr. Speaker. They don't get to read their report, so I table it for them so that they can read the report about the diabolical campaign that they ran, about why working from home was wrong.
It's hilarious. It's a boss move. However, just after the war the Iran war begins, timing, you know, okay, boss move, but there is the, come on, you know, come on, government.
Is this really what we're talking about?
Do you know what I'm saying? Because that was the other side of this.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've said it before that Labor is in danger of showing a bit of hubris in the parliament, and that's been in the context of its enormous parliamentary majority in the chamber. But now, as you say, with this kind of move, is it just like, come on, get your head back in the game? Is it that? At the same time, it's uncomfortable for the new leader, right? This is his first week at the Dutch box. It's uncomfortable. It's embarrassing. I mean, this report by Nick Minchin and Prue Goward noted the, quote, lack of reflection from senior figures. Guess who the senior figures are? One of them is Angus Taylor. It's noted the policy issues that blew up for the coalition during the election campaign. One of those was the decision not to support Labor's tax cuts. Again, Shadow Treasurer at the time, Angus Taylor. So it's embarrassing for him. And, you know, it just looks like the Liberal Party's trying not to dent another leader, and so hiding the truth. And really, you know, that never looks good. But yeah, I agree. Labor couldn't indulge themselves on this for very much longer, you wouldn't think.
Yeah, I think that's right. Look, you know, and they will be very unwise to labour the point. Let the Liberals bleed on their own, really, seriously. Like, they'll manage it themselves. But that review, if you look at some of its recommendations, I've got to say it's at odds with the approach that they're currently taking, and that's why it's very confusing. On multicultural communities, it warns that they have a broken relationship. These things, they're pivoting in another direction, really, chasing, I think, the votes they've lost to One Nation, at least in polling. So there is an inconsistency in the messages they've been given from this review.
Well, they're not reflecting on those messages. That's the, you know, that's the point, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we'll see where that takes them. But Farah will be the first test of that.
Oh, it will. And all eyes are on, you know, the date and the candidates ultimately and the way it will play out. Well, that's it for the Party Room today. But keep sending your questions in, because we love getting them and recording our special Question Time specific editions. We're fond of the voice notes. Send them to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
Yes, and of course, a reminder, friend of this podcast, great friend Mel Clark. She'll be back for Insiders on Background on Saturday. Mel's everywhere at the moment. Now she's hosting AM.
Yes, she certainly is. And remember to follow Politics Now on ABC Listen so you never miss an episode.
See you, PK.
See you, Fran.